then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew. And the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's September the 1st, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune. And hurrah, my voice for freedom is the rising of the moon.
Okay, I am really rushed tonight. It's Tuesday night, and I've basically had to, frankly, shit-can the whole program. Something has come up, which I'm not going to know until tomorrow exactly how it's worked out, but it's something that may require me to use up most of the next section of the program. So this first section is just going to be basically a lot of short pieces tacked together while I wait and see what tomorrow brings as far as the direction of the show goes, so forth and so on, and you can probably tell that I'm ad-libbing now. For those of you who don't know, i.e. those of you who are, for various reasons, without personal computers or access to the internet, I recently completed the first two sections of the fifth Northwest Independence novel, which has been entitled Freedom's Sons. Now, this latest novel will detail the lives and the progress of three specific families through the first 50 years of the existence of the Northwest American Republic, one family of NVA volunteers, one family of white refugees from Chicago who have to flee ahead of the police to the homeland for safety as refugees, and then a third family of just ordinary people who are kind of split down the middle and who end up having their family divided by the whole revolution thing. Anyway, there's a prologue in this novel, Freedom's Sons, which will take up at first where the brigade left off at the Battle of Portland. And the next section is entitled After the Fire, in which the first year after the Longview Treaty is discussed. Now, then comes the second section called The Empire Strikes Out, which tells us of Operation Strikeout, which happens 12 years after the Longview Treaty, when the United States attempts to reconquer the Northwest by force. Now, these two are the only sections completed thus far, and because of their length, they will be published together as Volume 1. Now, Section 3 through 5 of Freedom's Sons will comprise Volume 2. I should start on them probably sometime in October, maybe around Thanksgiving, who knows. Now, one of the reasons that I'm publishing this in two volumes is because Section 1 and Section 2 combined runs for about 220,000 words, which is a good-sized novel on its own, and because of the space limitations on the print-per-order publishing services that we use in order to publish our books, there is a page limit on the number of pages in any specific book that can be produced by these techniques. The Brigade, for example, was 734 pages, and that's almost as long as that particular company is able to go. I think their maximum number of pages is 750, so we were only about like 26 pages short on the Brigade. The first two sections, as I said, are quite long. The entire book, my guess would be probably about 500,000 words. We're talking War and Peace length here. And so ordinary print per order publishing procedures probably will not be able to handle that, and we'll have to go for publication in two volumes. That's when we get the money to publish this in book form at all, which right now it isn't, and I'm not even worried about publishing Volume 1 in book form because we're just not at that point yet. We got several other projects that we've got to take care of first. I am publishing this first volume of Freedom's Sons right away on the internet. And that includes distributing copies for free in PDF format, because due to the usual financial strictures, as I said, actual paper book publication is still some ways off. And I want to make sure that if anything happens to me of either a medical or a legal nature, this novel does not end up just sitting on my hard drive, either because I'm in no condition to distribute it because I'm in the hospital or the morgue or whatever, or because the said hard drive from my computer is locked away in a plastic tub in the basement evidence room of some federal bureaucracy in the secret police. Now, in this month's issue of Northwest Observer, I've published a few excerpts from Freedom's Sons, Volume 1, for the benefit of those who don't have internet access, either by choice or through poverty, or due to the fact that they're in prison or whatever. Now, no, I'm not just indulging in movement narcissism, although I will print up a few hand-bound galley copies for the supporters who, as always, have made it all possible. These are so incredibly expensive to produce that I won't be able to make more than a few dozen of them. Now, in a lot of cases, the few short passages that I excerpt in our little newsletter is all some of the people on our list will ever read of the fifth novel until we can get it properly into print and then somehow get a copy into their hands, and there's no telling how long that will take. I may or may not utilize part of the fall building campaign for the Northwest Front to try and raise funds for publication of Freedom's Sons. I don't know. We'll just have to see how that goes. Like I said, we do have a couple of other projects that we have to take care of first. Okay, a few weeks ago I mentioned that I had received a visit from a gentleman who is doing his migration right, who was touring the Northwest, going to job interviews. He has informed me that he does, in fact, now have a job. I won't say where as yet because I don't want to do anything that might interdict or interfere with his relocation, but apparently he has received a job offer here in the homeland. He's accepted it, and he tells me that he and his family will be out here before the end of the year. And having met this man, I get the impression he's the kind of guy who says what he means and means what he says, and so I think we will definitely see him out here before too long. Now, he did give me an audio file describing to me how he went about his job search. I don't want to give this man's name for obvious reasons. Again, we don't want to jam up his relocation, but let's just call him Al. Anyway, this is Al's commentary on how he prepared and how he went about his job search in the Northwest homeland.
To all white men of courage, I'd like to talk today about how I approached my relocation to the Northwest from the East Coast, with particular emphasis on how I dealt with finding a job. Some of what I'll be talking about are universal principles that I believe will work for anyone. Other things are more specific to myself and people in similar situations. This is the approach that got me moved almost 3,000 miles, but your mileage may vary. Take what you can use and discard what you can't. I originally ran across the name Harold Covington at Occidental Descent. For anyone not familiar with that site, the author's idea is that by talking and blogging, Dixie will rise again. The Butler Plan is therefore a competing idea, and the Occidental Descent crowd get pretty bonkers about Mr. Covington and the Butler Plan. When I read this site, it got me curious, and after I read the Greg Johnson review, I ordered all four books at once and read them all. Then I downloaded and listened to 60 or so episodes of Radio Free Northwest. While I was doing all this, things got pretty crazy in the neighborhood, and I decided to get the hell out of Dodge. My time of reading and mulling it over was at an end. It was time to go. I contacted Mr. Covington, got my packet, and started the job search. For the most part, I could be classified as a white-collar professional working for a large company. The first thing I did was begin to explore internal relocation options. Usually, if your company will relocate you, you'll have 5 figures worth of expenses covered easily. I found a few and worked on them, but things just didn't seem to be moving along. So, I started to look outside my current employer. Rather than blanket my resume everywhere, I looked around and found some posted positions online at a company that looked fairly decent. Then, I did hours of research on it. I looked at their products, their financial numbers, read their entire website, and looked at reviews of current and previous employees on Glassdoor.com and similar websites. I looked at the recent news and got as good an idea as I could about what it was about. Next, I took the job descriptions for the positions I was looking for, and I broke them down into checklists. I scanned for every last buzzword and specific piece of knowledge and experience they wanted and I put everyone that I honestly could into my resume. Everyone with my background or who hasn't been living under a rock knows how to use Microsoft Office, but if they mentioned it in their job description, on my resume it went. Even though I have far more relevant experience than I could put on a single-page resume, I cherry-picked the most relevant items that I could match to my list of keywords. Bear in mind that I did this all honestly. I didn't embellish anything. Actually, I left a lot out in order to do this. You can always cover more ground in the interview. When I was done, my checklist only had a couple of items that I could not fit my resume to. But 9 out of 10 keywords were there. Nowadays, all of these resumes go through computer programs that use algorithms to match resumes to positions, but basically what they do is match keywords. So I gave myself an advantage by using, word for word, everything from the job description I possibly could. Another month went by, and I got a little impatient. I kept looking, but wasn't really finding anything. Yet, I had complete faith that in a short time I would have something to show for my efforts. Therefore, I actually started to pack things. I did just a little every day, enough to be that much closer to my goal. That was when something magical happened. I got calls from literally everyone I had contacted for employment. It could be a coincidence, but when I reflect upon it, I really don't believe so. There can't be any possible physical connection between my packing a few things every day and getting callbacks. But that's what's happened to me too many times. I think this is a manifestation of some force in the universe I don't understand and can't explain. By some weird cosmic connection, when you take just one little action to advance your goal every day, other unrelated matters just start to fall into place. So, for anyone else out there struggling with your relocation, take advantage of it. Assume you will succeed in the near future. Pack your bags. Now, a bit more on resumes. I suggest that you drop the objective line at the top of your resume. You know, the one about wanting to work in a dynamic, innovative environment at a progressive company with the opportunity for steady growth and blah, blah, blah. Your only objective for the time being is the company's objective. And since you only partially know or understand what that is at the resume submission stage, don't bother. You can't gain any points in the game with an objective. You can only lose points if something doesn't match up. An objective cannot be a qualifier, but it can be a disqualifier. Instead, put a professional summary at the top that makes your best case in one short sentence. For example, XYZ certified widget designer with 3 years supervisory experience, seeking relocation to Montana. Assuming, of course, that's where the job is, put your strongest case up front about who you are and what you can do. Usually companies struggle to find someone willing to relocate, so if you just happen to want to relocate to, amazingly enough, exactly where they are, score one for them. But seriously, if you write that you want to relocate to a particular region, be prepared to give them a reason other than to secede from the United States through armed insurrection and establish a fascist white supremacy to destroy Israel and boot out all the niggers. They will ask, and that's not what they should hear. So when you interview, have a politically correct reason handy. Try not to lie. If your family isn't there, don't tell them that they are. Give them a career reason, like more job opportunities along I-5 than in Dust Bowl, Kansas. Or, you just love to ski and the mountains of Idaho and Montana look more appealing than living in Florida. Since we're on the subject of interviewing, understand that even for blue-collar positions, behavioral-style interviewing is becoming the norm over the traditional method. The traditional interview is where you get asked questions like, what's your greatest strength? And, what do you like least about your current job? I still run into these old saws on occasion, but it's pretty rare, and you still can't lose by using the behavioral style answers with them. The theory behind behavioral interviewing is that your past behavior is the best predictor of your future behavior. So they say things like, tell me about a time when you had to juggle many conflicting priorities. Or, tell me about a time that you had to work with someone that you didn't get along well with. When you get asked this, they are looking for one specific, particular example. They want to know what the situation was, what action you took, and what the results were. I know because I've been on both sides of the table. So make it easy for them to hire you by giving them those three elements of an SBO, situation, behavior, outcome. Others call it PAR, problem, action, results. Whichever is easier for you to remember, just use it. You do not want to sit there like an idiot mulling over your life while they wait. To avoid this, prepare a list of 8 to 10 stories before you go and recall to yourself the relevant details of the situation, your behavior, and the outcome. Make them flexible enough to be used in many situations. Have one that involves you taking initiative, have one that involves showing adaptability in the face of change, have another that demonstrates your problem-solving skills. If you work in an industrial environment, have yet another where you show concern for the safety of yourself and even better other people. The best way to get these stories is to live them, so if you can't think of any examples of the proceeding, try and arrange some. Last thing on interviews, bring a portfolio for any job more complex than flipping burgers. If you're a designer and it's in any way possible, bring some drawings to support an SBO you might talk about. Now, if they're someone else's property, don't leave them at the interview, but demonstrate that you can work AutoCAD and know your dimensioning and tolerancing. Graphic designers, photographers, and writers probably already know this stuff, but it's amazing how seldom I see it in technical professions. You'll save far more time in being declined for positions you've invested time in pursuing than you'll lose by doing the legwork. That's about it for today, comrades. Remember, all things are ready if our minds be so. I'll see you in the Northwest.
First music break. In April of 1913, in Atlanta, Georgia, a Jewish manufacturer of pencils named Leo Frank was arrested and charged with the murder of one of his factory girls, a little white girl named Mary Fagan, who was 13 years old at the time. Now, I won't go into a long, involved description of the trial of Leo Frank, of the evidence against him, and of the virtual certainty that he was in fact guilty of the crime with which he was charged. But I will say this, just to give you an idea of how certain Leo Frank's guilt was. The main witness against Leo Frank, who, by the way, was the factory owner, and basically what happened was Mary Fagan showed up to collect her pay one day, and Leo Frank took her down to the basement and raped her and strangled her and tortured her to death. Anyway, the main witness against Frank at his trial was a nigger janitor named James Conley, and the defense did everything they could to try and pin the murder on Conley. The defense lawyer, a guy named Prosser, actually got up and yelled at the jury, "This is just an old black nigger. You're going to take his word over a white man?" You see, you got to bear in mind, in those days, Jews were considered to be white men in the South. And Leo Frank was not only a quote-unquote white man, he was a rich white man. So that will give you an idea as to just how guilty Leo Frank must have been, because you had a jury of white men in Georgia in 1913 who would take the word of a nigger in order to convict a rich white man. Which, if you follow all the lefty liberal cliches, that's not supposed to happen. And I agree, it probably didn't happen very often. But, I mean, for a jury in that day and age to take the word of a nigger and convict a white man of murder, that guy had to be really, really guilty. Anyway, Leo Frank was sentenced to death, but the Jews raised such holy hell, and they managed to bribe the governor of Georgia, who was an asshole named Slayton, who, by the way, just happened to have been a partner in the law firm that defended Frank. A little bit of conflict of interest there, but hell, we don't pay much attention to those things where Jews are concerned. Anyway, they bribed Governor Slayton to commute Frank's death sentence, and he and his wife took the money and promptly left the state. Again, which gives you an idea of what's going on there. So Leo Frank was transferred to a minimum security prison work farm in Milledgeville, Georgia. But believe it or not, in those days, by then it was 1915, in those days, white men weren't just the complete supine doormats that they are today, and there were people back in them days, actual white men, who weren't going to put up with that type of corruption, and they weren't going to put up with some Jew getting off from murdering a 13-year-old white girl just because he had money, and just because he could bribe a governor, and he and his co-religionists could corrupt the judicial process. And so a very highly skilled lynch mob, which it later turned out consisted of, among other things, a former Superior Court judge and some very high-placed people in the community, got together in not so much a lynch mob, but it was a raiding party. They more or less stormed the minimum security jail, the work camp. They grabbed Leo Frank, hauled his kosher ass out of there. This was in August of 1915. and they dragged his ass 175 miles to more or less the front door of Mary Fagan's house, and they strung his ass up on a pine tree, and this was almost in the shadow of Stone Mountain, Georgia. Now, out of the Leo Frank case and that particular lynching came two diametrically opposed organizations. The first was the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, that was founded for the purpose of allegedly protecting Jews from all this horrible defamation, blah, blah, blah. And the second group was the Second Era Ku Klux Klan, which was founded in 1915, again at Stone Mountain, Georgia. Of course, there was also a lot of influence at that time from the movie Birth of a Nation. But anyway, I find it interesting that that one particular incident was the wellspring, if you would, of those two particular groups. Anywho, there was a banjo and fiddle tune, a folk tune, that was circulating at the time, back in the 1913-1915 era, called Little Mary Fagan. And it's the ballad of a little factory girl who goes to her factory one day to collect her little pay packet, which was about $4 for a 55-hour week. And instead, she gets lured down into the basement and raped and murdered by her Jew boss. Now, this song was actually around long enough before it disappeared in order to be recorded. And I have one of those recordings to play for you today. This is from the late 1920s sometime, and the artist is Vernon Dalhart. And it's interesting, one of the few examples of genuinely anti-Semitic American folklore. Anyway, like I said, this is Vernon Dalhart, and the song is Little Mary Fagan.
Little Mary Fagan, she went to town one day. She went to the pencil factory to get a little pay. She left her home at 7. She kissed her mother goodbye. Not one time did the poor child think that she was going to die. Then a villain met her with a brutal heart, we know. He smiled and said to Mary, "You'll go home no more." He sneaked along behind her till she reached the metal room. He laughed and said, "Little Mary, you've met your fatal doom." Was the watchman, and when he wound the key, away down in the basement, little Mary he could see. He called for the policemen, their names I do not know. They came to the pencil factory and told Newt he must go. Her mother sits a-weeping, she weeps and moans all day. She prays to meet her baby in a better world someday. Judge Long passed the sentence, you bet he did not fail. Solicitor Hugh Dorsey, he sent the proof to jail. Astonished at the question, the angels they did say, why he killed poor Mary upon one holiday. Now come all you good people, wherever you may be, supposing little Mary belonged to you or me.
Okay, first off, let me cover one thing really quickly here. Recently, I had an intro packet returned because an individual in Florida who requested it insisted on giving me a weird quasi-Viking name of some Norse god or something like that, and the post office kicked it back to me. Guys, come on. The introductory packet of literature is the beginning of the NF contact process. and we need to get it into your hands. Now, the post office is erratic at best. Sometimes a nigger letter carrier will just shove whatever envelope is addressed to a certain place into the mailbox, and sometimes somebody actually checks the name against whoever's supposed to live there. They're usually not that conscientious, but it's the principle of the thing. Guys, you can't hide from the FBI or whoever you're afraid of. The very minute that you make a single internet post to VNN, Stormfront, or an email of a racial nature, they've got you if they want you. Since the Patriot Act, they don't even have to get a subpoena anymore to get someone's IP address and physical location. Some people do live off the grid without internet, true, but if you're listening to this podcast, you're obviously not one of them. If you're on the internet, any police agency who wants you for anything can walk right up to your door anytime they want. So, why bother to hide from your friends? When you give us a name and a mailing address for your introductory packet, it doesn't have to be your real name. A post office box is fine. But please make sure that it's a name and address where the post office will actually deliver mail. And yes, we need a first and a last name, usually, unless the nigger letter carrier is even more than normally sloppy. The post office will not deliver any mail addressed to simply Joe or Ben or Sherry or something like that. Guys, at some point, if you're ever going to be anything besides an internet Nazi, you have to take a chance and step out from behind the computer. With the NF, the first step is to receive a packet of literature. It's not so much about the leaflets and back issues of Northwest Observer will send you as it is about you yourself. Do you have what it takes to step out from behind the computer even for this brief time? It's not illegal to receive literature in the mail, but yes, it does involve that first tiny modicum of risk that you will be expected to take as a revolutionary. We can't do what we have to do with people who are afraid of the mailman.
Hi guys, this is Axis Sally. How often have National Socialists and white nationalists in general been referred to in the Jewish media as haters? In an age where perception equals reality, the enemies of our race have thrived on their portrayal of our cause as one of hate and intolerance for far too long. Knowing the natural tendency of humans to gravitate toward the positive rather than the negative, our enemies, in this topsy-turvy world, have succeeded in calling the good bad and the bad good, and have achieved a monumental propaganda victory by getting the vast majority of the public to believe it. By simply stepping forward, through their control of the media, churches, and other outlets, and declaring what is moral and what is immoral for all the world to hear, they have seized the moral high ground on all societal issues, especially those dealing with race and culture. Consequently, all those who wish to be moral will seek to obey what has been dictated from on high, not knowing or suspecting that the source of that information could be flawed or motivated by something other than goodwill. Unfortunately, most people have not developed adequate hindsight necessary to understand how today's morality has changed from that of history, that indeed most of the famous people of history, from Plato to Thomas Jefferson, would be considered far from moral by today's societal standards. There can be no greater morality than that of the survival of the white race, and yet this is the first age where those who espouse this viewpoint are widely viewed as evil and immoral haters. 70 years ago, a politician had a hard time getting elected in the South without Klan support. When the Klan marched, they marched in broad daylight down the streets of major cities to the cheers of an adoring public. At a rally today, 50 or so Klansmen need police protection from the hundreds and thousands of jeering fools. While this has much to do with the declining state of the overall quality of our movement, it also reflects the sheer magnitude of the change in white people's values. The white races, more than any other, historically have been the creators, the developers, and the sustainers of civilization, of culture as we knew it when, across Europe, vast cathedrals pierced the sky over great cities where white men and women carried out the struggle of their daily lives by striving to make them better through innovation, invention, and plain hard work. In short, they built a world from the ground up using nothing but their minds and their work-hardened hands. They spread from sea to sea, then across the sea and back again. When Magellan circled the earth and Cortez conquered the Aztecs with a handful against thousands, while Gutenberg was inventing movable type so that knowledge could be shared by millions, others were ensconced in the same primitive aboriginal state of life which existed thousands of years before. The truth is not hatred, but the truth. In the old times, nothing was more sacred than honor. Today, we have lost our very souls. Today, we are shadows of the men we once were. Instead of going west, we go to the nearest Blockbuster and watch a movie about it starring some Jew. Instead of being men, we cower like dogs, wondering all the while how our chains came to bind us. Instead of being real Christians, we fawn and prattle over some Judeo-preacher with a slick tongue, stuffing money into his sold-out pockets while he tells us to love and support those who hate the very name of God. We are a noble race, a race of philosophers, from Plato, Aristotle, and Pythagoras, to Descartes and Malthus, and Houston Stuart Chamberlain. We are a race of inventors, Da Vinci, Edison, and Bell, to the computer pioneers of the modern day. We are a warrior race, from Alexander the Great, Hannibal, and Scipio, and Julius Caesar, to Washington, Napoleon, and Rommel. All these we are, and more. To lift up our accomplishments, which would take volumes uncounted, is to in no way impugn the accomplishments, or lack thereof, of another. To regard our achievements with awe, pride, and the inevitable desire to increase upon them is, in fact, the first step to the betterment of our world because it displays a commitment to truth in this age of lies and deceit. If the white race, this race of warrior priests, philosophers, artists, and inventors, has been responsible for drastically increasing the standard of living of virtually all the world's populations, then what morality except pure unadulterated evil could justify her extinction? In truth, the moral high ground is ours, and it is our responsibility to persuade others of this. Am I called a hater for loving my family more than the family of another? If a man prefers his wife over another, does this mean he hates all other women? And yet this is the logic our enemies often use when they accuse us of hatred for loving or preferring our racial family more than another. They know that it is up to us, those who subscribe to a more traditional view towards race, culture, and society, to change the public perception of our struggle from one which seeks to destroy to one which will continue to build that grandest of high cultures, the Aryan culture. The enemy has taken this noblest of all ideals, that of the preservation of God's creation, and turned it into something twisted and evil. They have taken what is perfectly natural and right, the innate propensity of people to prefer their racial kindred, and called it hatred and bigotry. Now, if one is a hater for hating evil, then count me among them. There are not enough haters of vice, sin, and evil in the world. Would not the architect of a grand palace hate the man who brandishes the wrecking ball too soon? Would not the father hate the man who rapes his daughter? There is nothing wrong with hatred if properly placed, but on the whole, our movement is not and never has been about hatred. It is about building a new society based on the natural and historic order of things. Justice, the inevitable consequence of Aryan rule, will occur without the useless fog of fury which clouds the mind in times when a clear mind will be needed the most. Indeed, there is a thin line between hatred and justice. Thus, our message must always focus on the positive. The future of the world depends on the survival of the white race. Understanding this, it is imperative that racialists begin to rethink their motives, arguments, and overall ways of thinking when dealing with those volatile issues, and start to regain the moral high ground which has been lost by the endless waves of enemy propaganda. They must understand and communicate to others that our movement is not about unjust hatred, but a love for our own. Not about destruction, but building. Not about death, but life. Not about immorality, but a divine morality summed up in an intense love of God's creation and a desire to maintain what was good and right in the beginning.
Got an email from an individual who requests that I not release his name due to his position in the educational system, where it's apparently far worse to be a white nationalist than it is to be a drug dealer. Surprise, surprise. Dear HAC, I'm writing this email to inform you that I'm on a timeline here in northern Utah. I'm about to start my college course, which should take about 8 to 9 months to complete, plus a 1 to 2 month internship before I can start my income-providing pharmacy job. I'm 21 and reside in a cesspool known as Ogden, Utah. While in some ways it's not quite as degenerate as Alabama or Britain, it nevertheless is very draining to live in, and it's seemingly devoid of any racially conscious whites at all. I'm looking forward to leaving for good in the near future, so next year I can give updates as to how I'm doing with my job and when I can make my first scouting trip and meet other white nationalists for the first time face-to-face in summer or early autumn of 2012. Just as an aside, guys, you would be amazed how many people are in that situation. You may have listened to these podcasts for 18 months now, been on VNN Stormfront for God knows how many years, but you may never even have physically met another white nationalist. That's one of the reasons we need to form communities. We need to get beyond that. But anyway, I'm digressing again. Anyway, getting back to the email. I feel bad that I can't come sooner, but I'm literally stuck some 60 miles or so south of the homeland until I'm self-sufficient. I have to look at Mount Ben Lomond every day, waiting for the day that I can go north beyond it, leave Utah behind, and it's frustrating at times. If you remember my previous email, I went into detail as to my unique circumstances and all I'd been through. I'm not trying to make excuses. I'm not an idiot or an American yahoo. I am a young adult, up and coming in self-sufficiency, and thus am rendered incapable of coming home sooner, despite being a lot closer to the homeland than much of your audience outside it. Now, my correspondent then asks me some questions, some of which I cannot answer in public because of the taboo on naming names. Now, the way it goes is apparently I'm allowed to discuss character issues in general, but I'm not allowed to name names or cite specific examples of grotesque behavior on the part of people who claim to believe as we do, because that's disrupting white unity and fighting a feud. Never mind the truth or the facts, and never mind whether or not a specific incident has been all over the news media and YouTube, which in this case it has been. CNN can talk about these things. The local newspaper can talk about it. YouTube can talk about it, but we can't. Apparently them's the rules. Now, I mention this because I get this kind of email all the time, usually a couple of times per week, from people who are puzzled and confused about something they've seen or heard on the internet or on the news. And they want to know what the hell is going on with somebody. But I'm not allowed to talk about it lest I violate this completely bogus concept we have of so-called white unity. Or even worse, God forbid, I end up fighting a feud, quote-unquote. So, sorry, comrade, I can't answer your first couple of questions. So, you'll have to rely on the Southern Poverty Law Center to tell us what the hell is going on in our own movement, like we all do. But, to continue. Harold, you've talked about Jews and niggers before, but I feel that mestizos need some discussing as well, a kind of know-thy-enemy talk, since Aslan will border our Northwest Republic to the south, and a weakened Zog could try to incite them against us in the future if it's strong enough. Okay, Aslan is actually one of the topics that I cover in Freedom Sons Volume 1, which I'm now distributing for free, as I said in the early part of the program. Guys, from now on, a lot of your questions on here and by email will be answered by referring you to the appropriate Northwest novel. Now, I know that sounds like a cop-out and a shortcut and an invasion, but the reason that these novels were written is to answer as many of these constantly repeated questions in an organized, hard copy form. We need to let the books do their work. Next question. As one of the originators of the Northwest Migration, actually I'm not. The Northwest Migration was thought up many, many years ago, and I don't claim any kind of special status in it. Anyway, the question is, do you feel Pastor Butler should be played on the show? My recommendation would be his interview on Race and Reason, and edit together a few minutes of that, just a suggestion. Yes, I think that's a good idea. Can anyone direct me to that interview on YouTube, or better yet, send me an MP3 or WAV clip of it, and I'll certainly play it. Back to the email. A thought about your books. I am reading A Mighty Fortress currently, and all of a sudden I had an idea. How would the NAR deal with Zog in Europe attempting to prevent white people from immigrating? Hopefully Eastern Europe will become nationalistic and smash EU, UN, NATO, colored immigration, Zionist tyranny, all of that's in slashes. And in the case of Australia and New Zealand, would the NAR launch either naval or air force missions to pick up honorable white people suffering in those places and bring them northwest? Just an idea, take it or leave it. Okay, guess what the answer to that one will be. I refer you to Freedom Sons and also to The Hill of the Ravens, both of which make reference to these issues. Guys, I won't say that all of your questions are answered in the Northwest novels, but most of them are. I repeat, these books are designed not just as entertainment or political polemics. They were written with the specific purpose in mind of answering questions. And then the guy closes with some musical suggestions, which I'll put into the queue. Now, guys, look, I know how this sounds. But please, read the novels. I am not just an author looking to sell books. Hell, I'm giving the latest one away. but I am an author looking for readers who will understand what I'm getting at. Second music break. For our British listeners, I will say again what I've said before. Yes, I know that the Provisional IRA are communists. I have lived in Ireland. Furthermore, I've lived as the local people lived and not as a tourist or a rich Yank. I lost my bookstore in Dublin when the local provost boycotted me. I've traveled in the north. I was one of the first responders to the Baltic Exchange bomb in London in 1992, and so I've seen all of this firsthand, and I know whereof I speak. I'm not some silly Boston Irish asshole who spends 2 weeks or so in the summer every 5 years and Ballymagash or whatever, schmoozing and getting drunk with his long-lost Irish cousins who take him for every penny they can, and who therefore sounds off on all this nationalist stuff from a position of ignorance. Now, that having been said, we need to learn to differentiate between the provost's ideology and their strategies and tactics as revolutionaries. Once again, I have to remind everyone that as personally repugnant as these people's leftist ideology may be, whether we like it or not, they are a genuine white working class movement, probably the only one remaining in the world. And they managed to fight a major Western democracy and first-class military power to a standstill and force the British to buy them off. Plus, they have a hell of a lot of good songs. Now try to forget about the whole IRA thing when you listen to some of these numbers and imagine white people singing like this about the NVA and fighting for freedom in the Northwest. Or, for that matter, if you're British, maybe you need to start thinking in terms of armed resistance in England as well. Judging from the riots they had last month, I'd say your country's in pretty bad shape. I suspect you'd have a hell of a lot of sympathizers, especially if you could work up some good songs like this.
And it's down along the Falls Road, it's where I long to be. Lying in the dark with the Provo Company. A comrade on me left eye, another one on me right. A clip of ammunition for me little Armalite. I was stopped by a soldier, he said, "You are a swine." He hit me with his rifle and he kicked me in the groin. I begged and I pleaded, oh, my manners were polite. But all the time I'm thinking of me little Armalite. And it's down in the bog side, it's where I long to be. Lying in the dark with the Provo Company. A comrade on me left and another one on me right. And a clip of ammunition for me little Armalite. Well, this brave RUC man came marching up our street. 600 British soldiers he had lined up at his feet. Come out, you curly Fenians, come on out and fight. He cried, "I'm only joking," when he heard the Armalite. And it's down in Malahi, it's where I long to be. Lying in the dark with the Provo Company. A comrade on me left and another one on me right. A clip of ammunition for me little Armalite. Well, the army came to visit me, 'twas in the early hours, with Saracens and Saladins and ferret armored cars. The thought they had me cornered, but I gave them all a fright, with the armor piercing bullets off me little Armalite. And it's down in the new lodge, it's where I long to be. Lying in the dark with the Provo Company. A comrade on me left and another one on me right. A clip of ammunition for me little Armalite. Well, when Pryor came to Belfast to see the battles won, the generals, they had told him, "We've got them on the run." But corporals and privates, while on patrol at night, say, "Remember narrow water and the bloody Armalite." And it's down across the glen, it's where I long to be. Lying in the dark with the Provo Company. A comrade on me left and another one on me right. And a clip of ammunition for me little Armalite.
Hi guys, this is Axis Sally. You remember the notorious DREAM Act that Congress has repeatedly refused to give to Barack Hussein Obama? The law that was going to effectively legalize all illegal aliens by legalizing the ones who are going to school here or who snuck into the military, thus making them anchor babies who can then legalize all their uncles and cousins and mamacitas and bambinos? Well, he finally got tired of waiting, so he just took it. The Washington Times reports, bowing to pressure from immigrant rights activists, the Obama administration said Thursday that it will halt deportation proceedings on a case-by-case basis against illegal immigrants who meet certain criteria, such as attending school, having family in the military, or having primary responsibility for other family members' care. The move marks a major step for President Obama, who for months has said he does not have broad categorical authority to halt deportations and said he must follow the laws as Congress has written them. But in letters to Congress on Thursday, Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano said she does have discretion to focus on priorities and that her department and the Justice Department will review all ongoing cases to see who meets the new criteria. The move won immediate praise from Hispanic activists and Democrats who had strenuously argued with the administration that it did have authority to take these actions and said as long as Congress is deadlocked on the issue, it was up to Mr. Obama to act. Okay, now let's think about that last sentence. So long as Congress, for whatever reason, refuses to produce a desired result for some pressure group, the President of the United States is just supposed to give it to them anyway. Sounds nice. Trouble is, that kind of thing is largely what the entire U.S. Constitution was drafted by the Founding Fathers in order to prevent, the exercise of arbitrary power by the President. Ever hear of checks and balances? The President of the United States is not supposed to make policy and implement policy all on his own. The exact constitutional phrase is that he is to seek the advice and consent of Congress. For Obongo to do something like this is in fact an impeachable offense, but I don't think we need to hold our breath for the trial. The goal of the Democrats is clear. Legalize the 30 million illegal aliens in this country so that they can not only vote Democrat, but bring in their cousins and uncles and bambinos from all over the third world to vote Democrat, thus giving perpetual power to the Democrat Party and effectively creating a one-party state similar to the way the PRI ruled Mexico for 70 years. Sounds bad, eh? Gee, I guess we all better call Rush Limbaugh and complain.
Okay, now for the grimly serious part of the show. I've been made aware over the last week that our friends in the silk suits have been sleazing around the Northwest again, looking for anybody who will dish on Kevin Harpum, the Spokane backpacker, or just talk to them in general. They've got some problems with Harpum's upcoming trial this month over the bionic backpack incident in Spokane last January. For one thing, in March he was physically seized and dragged away to a federal facility, and nobody bothered to tell him that he was under arrest or read him his rights for almost 3 hours. The defense was able to prove this at a preliminary hearing, and that was a bit too much even for a federal judge, who excluded all the statements that Harpum made before he was read his rights. Interestingly, the U.S. attorney tried to defend this on the grounds that this was a so-called quote-unquote terrorist case, and the FBI could therefore do anything they wanted to do. The judge wouldn't go for it, though. I wonder if the postponement of Harpum's trial, which was originally scheduled for August, was so that the prosecution could go shopping for a different judge. Another problem is the fact that Kevin Harpum has an alibi. He could not possibly have planted the alleged explosive device because he was nursing his sick father in Kettle Falls up on the Canadian border. I'm not sure the exact timeline for January the 17th, but it goes something like, at 20 to 10 in the morning, there was no backpack on the bench, and then at 10 o'clock, all of a sudden, three quote-unquote sharp-eyed city workers discovered what the FBI claims was this highly sophisticated explosive device, so sophisticated that it had wires sticking out of it for the so-called sharp-eyed city workers to see. In other words, they know to about a 20-minute window when the backpack made its appearance on the park bench, and they also know that unless he has winged feet like the god Mercury, there is no way that Kevin Harpum could have driven from Kettle Falls to Spokane and back again, which I believe is something like a 3-hour trip, planted the backpack and then made it back home in time to be seen by several other witnesses besides his dad. Basically, Kevin Harpum did not plant that backpack, and the government doesn't seem to have too much choice but to acknowledge the fact. So our friends in the silk suits have altered their story to fit the inconvenient facts. Now that's not the way it's supposed to go for real detectives who make their suspects fit the evidence and not vice versa. But then the FBI aren't real detectives, they're political police with a political mission to suppress dissent. They are now wandering all over the Northwest looking for the mysterious second man, some as yet unknown party who allegedly did the planting of the so-called bomb that Kevin Harpham supposedly made. And they're having all kinds of fun with that because an open-ended and vaguely defined investigation like this gives them all kinds of leeway to harass and annoy and gather intelligence on just about anybody they damned well please. So if they show up on your doorstep wanting to, quote-unquote, just ask you a few questions, then that's what it's about, officially. They claim that they're looking for the second man. What they're really doing is building files on white people in the Northwest who may be involved in any kind of legal dissident activity and involved with the Northwest Front in particular. They're cruising around the Northwest using this case as an excuse to try and develop informants and root around in people's trash and visit people's employers and basically to try and buffalo and intimidate anybody who dares to dissent against this regime's policies, including some of our Northwest Front people. So, let's go over our protocols for dealing with these creatures again. First off, you are under no legal obligation of any kind to speak with a federal agent or to so much as give him the time of day unless he has a warrant, in which case you give him 5 words, I have nothing to say. If you are so foolish as to speak to them, however, probably in the mistaken impression that you can play with them or make friends of them or put one over on them, then do not lie to them. That's a federal offense, and they can use it as an excuse to arrest you and abuse you in various ways in custody. Never, ever make the mistake of assuming any human qualities in these people that you can reach or persuade or befriend or deceive. These are not people we're talking about here. They're tarantulas who camouflage themselves as human beings. They have no human emotions, no human morals, no human feelings. They will commit any crime or atrocity their bosses tell them to commit for money or to further their career. I say again, federal agents are not people. They are venomous, predatory insects, and they destroy their prey. That's you. If federal agents approach you at any place or time, they are approaching you with the intent to do harm to you or to your family. They serve a system that uses human beings and human lives as its raw material to be sucked in, processed, chewed up, and spit out in the form of goo, kind of like a mincing machine. Federal agents only approach those whom they intend to drag into the machine and throw on the conveyor belt to be processed. If they show up uninvited on your property or at your place of employment, and they do not have a warrant, you should politely ask them to leave. I say again, politely, do not shout, do not show aggression, do not tell them all about how you know the law and you have rights. No, you don't. And since 9/11 and the Patriot Act and the Military Commissions Act of 2006, they don't even bother to pretend that ordinary people have rights. You need to be unfailingly polite to federal agents, especially FBI, so that they don't use anything you do or say as an excuse to assault you or force their way into your home. No other reason, certainly not because they deserve any courtesy or respect from anyone. They don't. Always remember that you are dealing with armed criminals who have the power to do pretty much anything they want to you. If one of them wants to take out his weapon and put a bullet in your head, the chances are very good that he will get away with it, especially if the only other witness is his partner. Now, this is one reason you need to refuse to let them into your home. Remember all that bullshit about Jeff Hughes allegedly brandishing a flare gun before he was cut down by 10 bullets. This is one reason that you need to refuse to let them into your home. Make your brief conversation take place with them on the porch, or on the lawn, or in the street, where there's always a possibility of passersby who might be witnesses if the federal agents break the law, as they so often do with impunity. The first thing you do when they show up on your doorstep is to ask to see their identification. Look at it closely. Don't let them just flip their badges and stick it back in their pocket like it was Sam and Dean on Supernatural. Make sure you get their names. Then ask, do you have a warrant? If the answer is no, if they say, we just want to talk or we just want to ask a few questions, you reply with the 5 words, I have nothing to say, and then you close the door. Don't slam it. but close it, cutting off contact with the secret police. If they attempt to force their way in, or if they stand there on your porch doing Jack Bauer impressions, threatening you or shouting at you, do not resist them or respond in kind. They're trying to provoke you into doing something that they can arrest you for. Do not bandy words with them. Do not engage in an extended conversation of any kind, because they want to get as many words as possible out of you in order to data mine whatever you say and use the information that they obtain in order to do harm to you or to others. It is entirely possible, and now legal under post-9/11 laws and procedures, for them to wear hidden recording devices and record anything you say. You need to physically cut yourself off from them as soon as possible, either by closing the door or by breaking contact and going inside your house or apartment. If they persist and they force their way into your presence, either with a warrant or without one, and if they attempt to coerce or wheedle you into answering questions, you answer only with the five words that may save your life. I have nothing to say. Remember, probably the majority of the men and the women who are in prison today are there because they talked their way into their own cells. They tried to explain it all, and they just dug themselves deeper and deeper. They made statements prior to their arrest or while in custody, which gave the police and the FBI a baseline to work with in order to do harm and process those people through the machine that feeds them. I don't know if you've ever read or seen on TV anything about the FBI Training Academy at Quantico, Virginia, but if so, you will be aware that one of the major fields of study and training there for FBI agents is how to develop and handle informants. The FBI admits in their own manual that an agent is only as good as his informants. The fact is that these people really aren't very good at what they do. The FBI are not real cops. Like I said, their mission is political, and their whole modus operandi has nothing whatsoever to do with solving crimes or enforcing the law or with protecting and serving anybody. Like all secret police, their purpose has to do with maintaining the present regime in power and preventing change. The simple fact is that most FBI agents are incompetent as investigators and detectives. They couldn't find the men's room without a wiretap or an informer, and even then they'd have to offer the informer immunity in the witness protection program. The main goal in almost any first contact of this nature is to see whether or not the Bureau can find someone who will talk to them about anything. Sports, the weather, anything at all. And if you do, the precedent has been set. You have talked to them, and they will make a note of that fact in their report, and from then on, whenever anything happens, guess who's going to be rolling up in your driveway or stopping by at your workplace or calling you to come downtown to the federal building. And once you talk to them at all, they take that as tacit consent to be an informant, and you will find that you can't quit when you try to step back and break contact and stop the periodic visits by clamming up. You will find that your so-called new friends become ugly and threatening. I cannot emphasize how absolutely vital it is to say nothing to federal agents, no matter how innocuous it may seem. You may be responsible for a friend or a loved one or someone you don't even know being murdered or dragged away to suffer the tortures of the damned. No one with any sense of decency wants to have another human being, no matter what he's done, suffer one single day of torture in this country's places of torment and punishment on his conscience. Nothing can ever erase or excuse that.
Whatever you say, say nothing. When you talk about you know what, or if you know who should hear, you know what you'll get. It'll take you all to you know where. Sake, don't let anyone hear you sing it, sing it all. And whatever you say, say nothing. When you talk about you know what, or if you know who should hear you, you know what you'll get. They'll take you off to you know where, for you wouldn't know how long. So for you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you singing this song. You all know what I'm speaking of when I mention you know what. And I fear it's very dangerous to even mention that, for the other ones are always
although you may not see. And if anyone asks who told you that, please don't mention me. And
whatever you say, say nothing when you talk about you know what. Or if you know who should hear it, you know what you'll get. They'll take you off, you know where, but you wouldn't know how long. So for you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you singing this song.
You all know who I'm speaking of when I mention you know who. Or if you know who should hear you, you know what he do. So if you don't see me again, you'll know why I'm away. And if anyone asks you where I've gone, here's what you must say.
Whatever you say, say nothing when you talk about you know what. Or if you know who should hear you, you know what you'll get. They'll take you off, you know where, but you wouldn't know how long. So for you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you singing this song. Enough about so-and-so, not to mention such-and-such. And it better end my song, I've already said too much. For the less you say and the less you hear, the less you'll go astray. And the less you think and the less you do, the more you'll hear them say. Oh, whatever you say, say nothing but when you talk about you-know-what. For if you know who should hear you, you know what you'll get. Oh, they'll take you off, you know where, but you wouldn't know how long. So for you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you singing this song. And whatever you say, say nothing when you talk about you know what. For if you know who should hear you, you know what you'll get. They'll take you off to you know where, for you wouldn't know how long. So for you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you singing this song. And whatever you say, say nothing when you talk about you know what. But if you know who's should hear you, you know what you'll get. They'll take you off, you know where, but you wouldn't know how long. So for you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you singing this song. For you know who's sake, don't let anyone hear you singing this song.
Now, one thing by way of full disclosure. A small number of you know that last March, during the first wave of visitations, I violated my own rules here, and I spoke with two individuals who came to my door claiming to be from the Spokane police. At least they had Spokane police credentials at that time, I checked. One of them apparently was, in fact, a Spokane police officer, and I was a little dubious about the other individual, and it turned out that A, the alleged Spokane Police Department email he should have if he was legitimate does not exist, and B, I couldn't get a straight answer out of anybody at the Spokane cop shop when I called them as to whether or not this so-called officer of theirs even exists at all, which makes it likely that he was some kind of fed posing as a Spokane police officer using courtesy credentials. Now, that's probably illegal, but federal agents don't have to obey the law. It's kind of like Obama halting deportations. Technically speaking, the 30 million illegals are breaking the law, yes, but no one's going to do anything about it. So technically some things are criminal offenses, but if a federal agent does them, nobody's going to do anything about it. So you can't really call them crimes if there are no consequences. I take from the fact that the Spokane detective I spoke to, the real one, at the police station, seemed to be passionately disinterested in the whole thing, that there was, in fact, something hinky going on, but it was with the knowledge and concurrence of the Spokane Police Department. Otherwise, you'd think that the police would be a lot more interested in someone impersonating one of their department's officers. Now, I figure if this guy really were a Spokane detective, the police department would just have said so. And if he was an outright imposter, on the other hand, they would have asked for a lot more details. But instead, what I got was waffle. So I figure that at least one guy who visited me was some kind of FBI agent carrying a local police badge, thinking I would never pick up on it and never check him out. In addition, I am now informed that the individual whom I thought checked out as a Spokane cop is now apparently claiming to be an FBI agent to others whom he has approached. Although that may be a miscommunication on our side, I need for some people to get back to me on that. I presume the various alphabet soup agencies have noted in my file that I've so far refused to speak to FBI, Secret Service, and Homeland Security. But back in 2008, I did speak to the Astoria police officer that the Secret Service sent in first, alone, to make sure that I wasn't armed and dangerous. I'd been writing some rather unkind things about Barry on one of my blogs, and the Secret Service apparently got all paranoid about it. So they sent in this one Astoria cop with some screenshots from my blog, and he wanted to know what was going on. He says, I've been reading this. You don't like Obama, do you? And I said, no, not particularly. And so we stood in the doorway, and we had a little chat. And he said, well, the Secret Service wants to come and see you. And I said, well, why don't they? And they said, well, basically, they sent me first just to make sure that you're not some kind of crazed, you know, militia guy with a whole apartment full of automatic weapons. And I said, well, you know, if I was some kind of Looney Tune with an apartment full of automatic weapons and I was inclined to commit acts of violence, you realize they just sent you in here all alone. And you would have caught the brunt of it. And the cop kind of laughed and he says, yeah, that fact had not escaped his notice. Interestingly enough, this guy must have put in a fairly good report on me, something to the effect of, hey, this guy's harmless. He's just a writer. You know, leave him alone. Because about 3 weeks after that, I saw his picture in the paper. He had been suspended from duty by the Astoria Police Department for some just really Mickey Mouse charge, allegedly going to see his girlfriend when he was on duty or some such BS. I mean, it was obviously somebody at the Astoria Department took a hatchet to this guy, because it's the sort of thing that cops do all the time, and most of them don't get, you know, fired for it and arrested for it and all this nonsense, but they really came down on this poor bastard. And I've often wondered if maybe it was because he filed a favorable report on his meeting with me. Anyway, getting back to this little visitation I had back in March, the two men I refer to may well have disguised themselves as Spokane police and used false credentials with or without the collusion of the department. Not that it matters, because if they did, nothing's going to be done about it. They're federal agents, and they're above the law. Anyway, what I'm getting at is that on March 30th, I did in fact speak for a short time to two individuals claiming to be Spokane police detectives. I did so in violation of my own policy on contact with these people, but I did so for a reason, to see if this was a serious attempt to link anybody in the NF's circle of acquaintance to the Bionic Backpack, and if it was a serious interrogation. As it turned out, it wasn't. It wasn't even really much of a fishing expedition. It was pretty clear that the lead individual just wanted to get a look at me, or else he just wanted to play peekaboo, I see you, try and see if I would spook or rattle when they showed up on the door. This appears to be what's going on now, with all these sleazeballs cruising the Northwest, visiting people and calling them on the phone and leaving them sinister messages and this sort of stuff. Now remember, if they're standing on your doorstep being polite and wanting to come in, that means that they have no evidence that you've actually done anything. If they did, they wouldn't be acting polite. They'd be kicking in the doors with SWAT teams and body armor and roaring and killing your dog and pointing guns at your four-year-old's head. They know that where so-called white supremacists are concerned, they can pretty much do whatever they want. And like Obama's 30 million future Democrats, no one will punish them even when they break the law. Anyway, what I want to say about that incident is this. If anybody has to violate these protocols of mine and put themselves at risk trying to find out what the secret police are up to, let it be me. It's part of my job description. It's what you pay me the big bucks for. Now, you may say that sounds like do as I say, not as I do, and you'd be right. In this case, yeah. Do as I say, not as I do. Just because I play grab ass in a pit full of venomous spiders, that doesn't mean that you should. You may say, well, Harold, why should you get all the fun and get to play with the FBI guys? This is not playing. This is deadly dangerous. I'm not kidding, people. Talking to the FBI or other secret police about anything for any reason, and for even a short conversation, falls into the category of an extreme sport. It's like hang gliding or skydiving or NASCAR racing. It can get you killed if you screw up. So, on the rare occasions when this has to be done, let me do it. No kidding, guys. Some of you have families, and some of you are young enough to still have some kind of future that they can take away from you. They have things that they can threaten you with. I'm pretty much at the age and the state of health where they can't really threaten me with too much. I don't have any of these hostages to fortune that most of the rest of you have, so let me handle any tete-a-tetes with the secret police. And even I won't do that unless I believe it is absolutely necessary. Besides, right now I figure I'm the one the regime really wants to silence, so let them deal with me directly. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha on the bond. Freedom.